thanks for joining us for another intriguing edition of the Stack Pack. Perhaps you can help solve a mystery. How's it going? What's up, guys? This is the Stack Pack, back for a special episode this week, guys.
Very, very special episode.
Yeah, we're covering Season 3, Episode 11, right?
Yes,
according to the people at Amazon and Hulu right now. And we have a bunch of special guests, guys. So, as always, I'm David Howell, joined by my other Stack Packers. We got Eli in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and Rodan on the road.
What's up?
Getting
What's
a up? Hurricane out of Florida, right?
Yeah, running from a hurricane.
Yeah, awesome. So what's up with that? You were supposed to play a show in Tallahassee, and now you're
well,
down the street?
I was supposed to get, like, 3 days off in Pensacola, do a show in Pensacola, then go to Tallahassee, and then finish my week off in Miami.
So it's all Florida.
But thanks to Hurricane Michael, I don't think we're doing Pensacola anymore, or Tallahassee. But maybe Miami? I don't know. I got to be up at like 9 a.m. to get onto a bus to go somewhere.
Cool, man. Well, stay dry. All right. And two very prominent members of the Truth and Justice Army. Well, actually, three, I guess. We have Eli and Chris, who run the Facebook, you know, admins on the Facebook side of things. And of course, we're also joined... The fan page, yes. And we're joined by the man himself, Bob Ruff. What's up? Thanks for joining us on our little podcast.
I know.
I'm super excited about this. I've been looking forward to it for 42 minutes.
We had a little slow start here.
Do you actually have like a speaker's clock like on the other side of your screen there that's like counting up on how long we've been dealing with this bullshit?
His tab. He's working like a lawyer, yeah. And he's timing us, and he's going to send us a bill after it's done.
Right. Four separate Skype calls.
We're on the clock.
It's a lot to organize.
I appreciate you guys having me on, though. This is, you know, Chris and you haven't introduced Chris yet. I'll introduce him. Chris Brinkley, the one of the creators and admins of the fan page, and Elias. They do that page is a bitch to run. There's like what, like 7,000 angry little people on there all the time, arguing about murders. Yeah. And they handle all of it along with Holly and Jill. So I was happy to come on and talk about Robert Stack using the R word multiple times. It's jarring to watch that episode.
Oh yeah, dude, not the proper nomenclature, dude.
Hard R's.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff when we go through these episodes. It's just like, oh man, that's so dated. But you have to bring it up. You have to bring it up. But yeah, we'll get to that. So, we're another reason why I wanted to have Bob on this episode specifically is because it's a. There's a big chunk of this episode is a wrongfully convicted kid, and that's what they're thinking. We'll get into the case and kind of break it down, but first we have some fun. Just let you guys know you're not going to see me because of my notes, but first we have a little fun. We're gonna talk about, you know, the unexplained, and we have a pretty fun one. We're gonna be talking about a lady named Coral.
I'm glad I'm not the only one that, like, as soon as he said it, was like, Coral,
get over here, Coral. Yeah. No, her name is Coral Polge. Oh, man, that's such a, like, that's some English shit right there, guys.
Yeah, I thought so when this started, I was like, oh, this is going to be complete bullshit.
did anybody else think Harry Potter when she started talking?
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah, the music didn't help either. Right. That name, Coral Polge. So just to get into a little backstory about Coral. This story is March of 1990. You know, Stack's got to start with a date always. In March of 1990, Coral draws in front of a bunch of mooks. They pay $15 a head. And they're sitting there, and she's just drawing on an overhead projector like a third grade teacher. I don't know. Do they still do that?
No, they don't. I don't know. I'm pretty sure they all have like projectors and stuff.
What's the going rate for like an event like this? Like, he had to state like they paid $15 a head. Like, I mean,
that's a lot for what?
Was
like,
that a
yeah,
lot
1990?
Back in the day? I mean, people drop hundreds of dollars to listen to like former politicians talk about bullshit. I mean,
yeah. These people want to hear from their dead relatives.
She's no crossing over with John Edwards, that's for sure. But yeah, so she drew dead folks, y'all.
And I must say, it was in the like most generic way ever, like as possible. So we'll get more into that, but it's just
they kind of stressed that they're very simple, you know, they're not anything special. They're very simple drawings, but they have a keen likeness. Yeah, it's real nice British accents in this one. The Brits taking over our unsolved mysteries.
She figured out that their grandmother, the man's grandmother, was an old lady, in fact. And she drew an old lady.
Yeah. That looks exactly like...
What about that country smile?
Right. It looks like everyone's grandma.
It's like maybe a lot of people just kind of dressed the same back then. Right. Maybe it's that. So, she says that it's sort of like what she calls automatic control. You know, she draws them, but she has help from the other world, from the spirit realm. And so, you know, then there's like a bunch of drawings. Like Bob said, there's like an old lady. She drew it in 1984, and this lady's been dead since 1944. And then, you know, it's just stuff like that. A drawing in 83, someone died in 1933. You know, you get the picture. And she says for 40 years she's been possessed by this weird ability.
Yeah, that she doesn't even know what she's drawing. It, like, she even mentions that her hand just kind of moves, right?
So it's like drawing a Ouija or what?
Yeah, like a Ouija board kind of. Something just takes control.
Yeah, but it's not demonic at all. It's just like, well, I mean, she seems pretty... Maybe she's dark, man. She doesn't even see that that's some dark fucking magic she's dealing with. Some satanic panic.
Yeah, for real.
Stack gives us this spiel about how everybody's always, you know, the thought of life after death is something men have thought about for, you know, forever. And it's like, oh yeah, cool, thanks for that info. And then they talk about mediums and clairvoyance and how some of them are charlatans. Sometimes there's some words that just don't get used today in these episodes.
I enjoyed the use of the word charlatan. That and the other word, as I said earlier.
Yeah, that was a little...
Both were jarring.
Yeah. Charlatan in a different way, like in an old like Frankenstein, like pitchforks kind of movie way. At this point, it's second nature to her. She's drawn over 100,000 eerie photos.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second. 100,000 drawings.
Yeah. Like,
she said, I stopped counting at that
point. Yeah, she said she stopped
counting.
How
the hell do you count to that point?
Yeah, it's like, I would have stopped after 1,000.
That's a lot of drawings.
Did anybody else catch the part where Stack said that some of them don't bear any resemblance, but some of them do?
Yeah, and they only show the ones that do.
Like, how does she just get it wrong? She does a thing where she puts her hands in their hands if she has this gift, and then the spirit just gives her a different face, old lady to draw.
It's like, that's not anybody I know.
And then you start thinking of the 100,000 drawings that she did. How many of them were just shitty?
Like a bunch.
They only show us like maybe 15 tops.
Well, see, that's the thing. Those 15 were all her success stories. Only 16 out of the 100,000.
Is this your grandmother?
Oh, my goodness.
It looks... I see Dan. Wow. It looks just like her, doesn't it?
How'd you know?
It came right through the screen.
Scammy.
Bob Ruff, psychic artist. I think that's a different podcast.
Did she, in fact, have hair? Did she have hair and a nose? Did she have a nose?
She did have a nose.
Lips and eyes.
That's it.
That's her.
Uncanny.
I have to just say, like, how many people did she go through this process with that were like, you're describing my grandfather, but that looks like Hitler.
Why did every single one of them have a Hitler mustache?
Yeah, they all
every
did.
Every drawing they showed.
It was big back then.
The one curly cue guy.
It was big back then.
I'm like, oh, she's drawing Charlie Chaplin, Hitler.
Took an ugly turn there for a minute.
So we get our skeptic. We need the skeptic, right, in these stories. And we're introduced to a photojournalist named Peter Cook, who went there on assignment, so not on purpose, not a believer. And in the reenactment, at least, he's like, oh, just show me some of your drawings. And then she's like, no, sit down. Come here. Come hither.
Come hither.
Sit with Coral.
Sit with Coral.
She touches his hands.
Come, sit with me. She always refers to herself. Coral always refers to herself in the third person. Come, sit with Coral. Coral will make you tea and crumpets.
Now we're on the set of The Hobbit?
Yeah, of course they'd never met before, and she started drawing his grandma, and he said his stomach turned. The rosy thing, yeah, she said that the grandma had, the lady had rosy cheeks, and she thought her name was Rose, and that she drank out of a bucket.
Yeah, she drank out of a rain bucket.
She was born in the 1800s. Of course she drank out of a fucking bucket.
That's pretty vague. And that's like the one thing that her spirit conjures up after all these years is like her just remembering that fucking water bucket she would drink out of.
Right. Yeah. That's the information that she wants to make sure that people know now in the afterlife is the bucket talk.
Yeah. We used to drink out of a bucket. It's just the ultimate, like, back in my day from beyond the grave.
She doesn't say, "I love you, grandson. I wish I could have met you." Just, I want you to know.
I drank from a bucket.
I once drank out of a bucket.
I drank rainwater out of a rain
bucket. Oh, right. Yeah. It was in fact rainwater.
Yeah. From a rain barrel.
And what she says to the guy is, she says, like, "I feel like she used to keep water in a water butt, and that's where she would get her drinking water from." I was like, "Wait, what? Water butt? Bucket? Oh, butt?" Oh. I had to put it on a closed caption, and she says, "Water
butt." Oh, the
butt.
Closed caption is very unreliable for... I watched it on Hulu today, and it's the same with Amazon.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
It's the same person.
We're sitting here looking at it right now, and it's just like, that is not what she said. Not at all.
Yeah.
So she also draws another family member, right? Like his mom? Doesn't she draw his mom?
Yeah, yeah.
Yo, I did notice with the whole Rosie thing, I was thinking, my first thought was, well, she obviously Googled it until I remembered that it was
drawn in 1984.
Yeah, 1984. Yeah,
right, or whenever it was, yeah.
She obviously microfiched it.
Yeah.
Hold on. Hit pause on the drawing.
Hey, Alexa.
She obviously Dewey Decimal System. Dewey. Yeah, okay, sorry. That was, boo.
Look at how great our technology has come. We have now disproven all the crazy people that draw things because they just went on Facebook.
Yeah, they just got on Facebook now.
So.
When that generation learned how to use the internet, it's all downhill from here.
Yeah. They're creeping into Instagram now.
Oh, yeah.
They're abandoning Facebook and moving on to Instagram and Twitter.
We must all flee to Snapchat. No, I can't do that. Anyway, yeah, so she also drew Peter Cook's mom, and Peter Cook was like, "Wow, cool." And then we get her backstory, her like origin story, if you will. How
she got her powers. Like a mutant.
Yeah, how she got her powers.
This just turned into a Marvel movie.
When she's struck by lightning.
After World War II, her mom was like emotionally, like, I don't know, scarred, or she took her mom to a spiritualist for some reason, and the medium came up to her and said, "You're a psychic artist," and she was like, "What's that?" And he's like, and she was like, "You're an artist, aren't you?" And she was, and then she said that one day you'll be a famous medium, so she just became a famous medium. I don't know, nothing's adding up here, guys.
I'm impressed with the depth that you go into, because my entirety of my notes on that part of the episode say, artist draws dead people, ugly glasses, Harry Potter, Rose, no internet.
No internet.
What a great investigator, Bob. Just saying.
Right.
He looks at clues. There's a clues.
There's nothing really to investigate. I did like what she said when... This is the line as she gets after the medium tells her that she's going to be a famous medium. She said, "I thought she was completely balmy." B-A-R-M-Y. Barmy. She was completely balmy. I've never heard that.
I've never heard that either.
I consider myself a bit of an Anglophile. Barmy. I know what it means. No explanation needed.
She does have ugly glasses, though.
Yeah, I mean, that's that 90s, that late 80s, early 90s curse, right? Just those, like,
the thick frames. Cap
glasses.
Yeah, yeah. Anyways, they show her drawing more dead people. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and then there's like another lady who she draws a family member, and she's like, "I was devastated, shattered and devastated," but she's like smiling the whole time.
Oh, yeah.
Which is weird.
So I have a question for you guys about this, because like if I heard it right, she drew this picture of this person she's never met, yet she knows it's her, right? Like, is that what she said?
No, I think she just draws people and thinking, oh, you might know this person.
Yeah, she gets like a feeling of like a dead relative from like a person. Like, it's always somebody's like dead ass aunt or dead ass mom. Or,
and then the person identifies it. That's you're well, drawing
no,
my dad.
No, but the person that was supposed to identify her said that she had never met her before.
Right, she never met her.
But she still knew it was her.
Oh, you mean the family member?
The
had
family
never met
member
the other
had
family.
Never met the person that she knew.
I think they just meant that she had never met that they had never met the sidekick before that she had didn't have prior knowledge.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So of course Robert Stack leaves us with the question: is she just like a good artist with like you know very skillful and bullshit pretty much, or does she have some supernatural gift? What do we think, guys?
I think she's great at drawing Hitler drawings. I'm just saying.
Yeah, that's about it.
I'm sold.
Yeah, I don't know. This one's it's not my favorite. I prefer a silly ghost story over something like this. This is just kind of like, it's not spooky enough. The music was really good in this segment. But it's just not like, there's nothing there.
It's just like.
It's not mysterious enough to like care.
Maybe.
It was kind of how the Gray Man, we talked about a ghost who like warned people about
hurricanes. Yeah, I remember. Did you see the Gray Man, David?
Where the fuck was he today?
Sounds like a Guillermo del Toro movie. Like, the ghost is like, he's a good guy.
He's a good ghost.
Is that a real thing?
Yeah,
there's a gray ghost that warns people about hurricanes.
Yeah, if you see the Gray Man, the whole wherever you live gets totally destroyed, but not your house.
Yeah. So he's like a good ghost. He saves your stuff. So, anyways,
yeah, he's a good boy.
This is not the Gray Ghost. This was.
You know what bummed me out about relocating today was I was at Gulf Breeze.
What's that?
We could have recorded it.
Gulf Breeze
tonight.
Were the UFO,
the UFO
sightings. It's a Gulf Breeze UFO.
You slacked it.
No, I was saying I could have been recording from there tonight, but I had to evacuate.
Oh, okay.
That would have been really cool.
So this next case is a final appeal, which we get every now and then, and it's like literally somebody from jail trying to like get a second chance. Which is was it like we said is a reason we wanted to have the Truth and Justice Army to kind of hear this one because
this is right up their alley.
Yeah, it's a final appeal, and it's a really it's an unfortunate one. I don't know. It reminds me sort of the Brendan Dassey kind of situation. I mean, that's the most modern hook you can put into it in the true crime days we're living in now.
Yeah, it's like spot on. If anybody's familiar with the West Memphis 3 case, like
oh yeah,
same
that's
age,
right.
Same IQ, Jesse mm-hmm. Miss Kelly. You know, he had an IQ right about 70, 17 years old. So it was. Eerily similar to that one,
dude. They did this kid dirty. They did him so dirty.
Listen to them interview him was just like, oh my gosh,
yeah,
this is horrible.
So let's get into this.
It starts off because he says the producers got a startling call from this guy in jail saying that this kid was arrested for a crime that he committed. This guy in jail is like, I did this, and there's a kid in jail for it, and that kind of got the ball rolling.
Is that how that started?
Yeah.
I knew the guy from prison had called someone and confessed. I guess I didn't catch that he had called the Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah, he called their hotline.
Props to him, by the way.
Yeah. It's like he literally saw it like in prison, just saw it on TV, and he was like, well, that's fucked up. I didn't make a call.
Right. Who do I call? The police? My lawyer? His lawyer? Robert Stack.
I'm going to call Robert Stack.
The number is right on the screen, right there. Right. The telecenter, they call it. It's not a call center. It's a telecenter.
Is Robert Stack there?
So wait a minute. Was this like a part two? Did they cover this in seasons one and two?
No, they've never covered this. So the guy that confessed to the murder was the one that brought this to Unsolved Mysteries' attention.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So they were
it's
like,
pretty
what?
Crazy.
They're like, okay, we'll look into this.
Yeah,
this sounds like primetime gold.
Like I said, props to that guy,
no,
by the
for
way.
Real.
Because, like, wow. That's really stand up with him.
Well, that's cool. I mean, I like that they interviewed him and they kind of get his story, which we'll get into in a little bit. But yeah, definitely 100% props to that guy.
Yeah, there's a lot of good interviews on this one. So the kid in question, the innocent party in question, his name was Johnny Lee Wilson, and I'm going to use the Stack terminology for this one. Not Stack. There's writers. It was a different time. He's described back then as a mildly retarded kid, and he was arrested because he confessed. But of course, they say his IQ is like about 71 or something like that. So mm-hmm. they say that this confession was coerced.
Yeah, which by the way, I think he said, like, what is that, like a third grader level mental state?
Yeah, they said fourth grade at one point and then third grade at another point.
He gets dumber throughout the segment.
Right.
That's getting cut out.
The views of the Stack Pack are not necessarily those views represented by Bob Ruff, the Truth and Justice Podcast, or NBI Studios.
That's a good disclaimer there.
We're going to throw that in.
Yeah, I don't think that can go anywhere. This story takes place in Aurora, Missouri. This is a small town. Everybody know everybody. It's just that kind of place. Everybody knows Johnny. They said that he was emotional. He had the emotional development of a 10-year-old, whatever that means. That could be third, fourth grade. And then we get a sweet little talking head of his granny, Nellie Maples, who they never say her name, but that's a damn good name, isn't it? Nellie Maples. She's the grandma, and she says that he was such a good boy. He did have special education needs, but he was never a problem. She does mention that kids were bullies to him and didn't treat him very nice. But, yeah, she said, considering all things considered, he was a pretty happy kid.
Did anybody else notice that two of Cora's drawings look just like Nelly?
Oh, shit. That's how they're connecting the whole episode together, man.
Right. I thought it was part of the storyline, part of the arc.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking of it from that perspective, and I'm like, man, she must have had like a 70-80% chance by just drawing an old man or an old woman, you know?
Right.
Especially in a room full of mooks that spent $15 a head.
Right. Dude, it was like an M. Night Shyamalan movie. It was like as they're interviewing her, it's like, oh shit, remember when Cora drew a picture that looked just like that lady in the first act?
It's a twist. Yeah, so kids were an asshole to him, whatever. So it got to the point where this kid had to leave his bike at a neighbor's house, at a lady who lived close to the school that he went to, I guess, because kids would just fuck with his bike, which is super messed up. I don't know. It's like when you see like those old 50s movies of kids bullying, and you're like, kids aren't that mean, are they?
No. Sometimes they can be. Were.
But yeah, he had to leave. He left his bike at this place, at this lady's house. Her name was Colleen Martz, and she was real good friends with the grandma. Her family owned a business in town, and she was the last living member of this wealthy family that everybody knew in Aurora, Missouri. I don't know. How do we get into this? What's the segue to this part? Because on the Unsolved Mysteries episode, it's pretty rough, too.
Yeah, it just, like, cuts.
So basically, he dropped his bike off to go to school that day. Is kind of where it started. And then
cut to 8 p.m., the house is on fire.
Yeah.
Yeah. April 13th of 1986 is, you know, drops his bike off, leaves it, and then...
So, like, talking about, like, perfect scripting here, drop the bike off to connect him to the old lady, and then a fire happens. Where's the bike?
Yeah.
They never bring the bike up again? How they're connecting
him? I think they're just saying, like...
The bike was actually the device used to start the fire.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Right.
The bike tire.
But it was... They really left a huge gap there, because then they talked to the other... mildly mentally challenged person.
You know you want to say.
As Hal Stack said it, who points the finger at Johnny. But so the bike was just left out there. So, yeah, I think that it was used as an accelerant. Must be how it's connected.
Yeah, I think they're just saying, like, oh, this guy has ties. This is how he knows the victim. I think that's...
That he was there that day.
Yeah. So I guess you could say later that day... There was a fire, and they found out that it was started deliberately.
They told his side of the story that he had spent some time with his family. He was with his grandmother. He'd mowed the yard. And then eventually they were eating dinner, I think, and they heard the sirens, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, they went. They
were I got it here. Sorry. So the day starts with he's at home taping records with the neighbor boy. That's Nellie's words. Taping then he goes records. And mows a neighbor's lawn. At 5 p.m. he gets home, and the neighbor boy comes back over, and they tape albums till 7. And then after that, he puts up 9 posters in the bedroom with his mama. And then they go down to mail some letters, and then they go to Raimi's to get some things, which I guess is a store. And then they hear sirens on the way home. Mm. So they stop there, They're looking at the fire on the house on fire, and then that's where fucking Gary comes in, who's also mildly retarded.
God damn it.
Fuck you, Gary.
Unsolved Mysteries words. Sorry, you want to do a disclaimer again? Who's also mildly mentally ill. Fuck you, Gary. God damn it. We can't.
Gary really is an asshole.
He really is.
He was the biggest asshole in this whole story. I mean, we're talking about a man that comes in the third act that is confessed to violently murdering elderly people and burning them up, just like what happened to this poor woman, and still Gary's the asshole. Yeah. He's the biggest asshole in the story.
Gary's like, yeah, and they're still like, no, but this mentally challenged kid said that...
This other mentally challenged kid...
Wait, well, let's back up. What Gary told the police was that he was talking to Johnny during the fire, presumably after he gets there with his mom, and that he mentioned something about the lady being tied up. And the reenactment, it's real funny because he's like, the kid's like, well, you seem like you might know something about this. And then Johnny's like, reenactment Johnny looks over and he's like, you better not say anything or I'll beat you up.
You shut up, Gary.
I'll beat you up.
Did you notice how, like, Gary, the guy who played Gary, kind of delivered his performance like Pedro from Napoleon Dynamite?
I mean, right. That's everybody's asshole. That's everybody's delivery in Unsolved Mysteries. But just to back up, so they found burning house. They find the body, obviously, of this lady, Colleen, charred, and she's bound and gagged with duct tape. And they could tell it's deliberately set with gasoline. And of course, the town is shocked. And then, of course, after bitch-ass Gary tells the cops this, they arrest Johnny and they take him to jail. There's an insane 4-hour interrogation that started around 8:30 and ended right after midnight that night, where they were just like hounding him and just doing all the things that, you know, anybody familiar with Memphis 3 and how to make a murder, making a murderer,
God.
How to get away with murder, you know, the show with the Shonda Rhimes show. But I honestly don't know. I know the West Memphis 3 are fucking totally innocent, but I don't know about Brendan Dassey. But it's the same thing, like, these people that were not totally mentally capable being, like,
taken advantage,
you know, shoehorned and pointed, nudged in the right direction.
Yeah,
there's so much of that in this case.
Keep in mind, Gary, asshole Gary over here, took 6 lie detector tests, right? And he passed one of them.
He only failed 5 of them.
Only 5.
Like, I want to see the questions. Did he really say this? Yes. Why? So let's try it again. Are you sure you heard him? And then it like ends up at the end like, Gary, is the door open? Yes. He passed.
We got him. We got a winner.
We got a hit.
That's it.
It's fucking ridiculous the way the cops treated this case. So they went and searched the kid's house. The grandparents, the grandma and mom had saw no reason to not let them. And they immediately assumed that he had sexually assaulted this old lady because there was underwear in the drawer in his room. They said that was his mom's. That's weird, but...
Yeah, it's fucked. It's super fucked up. To be honest, that part of the story gave me a little pause. Like, first of all, I don't think that Johnny killed that woman, but Johnny's got problems, and I do not believe those are his mother's underpants in his bedroom. And if they are, might I add, if they are, that is equally as fucked up. I would rather have them be someone else's underwear than his mother's, if I can be honest.
Was it like a matter of free space in mom's room? Like, there's not enough, like, room for her.
How much space do fucking underwear take up? Women's panties. She was not a big woman. Grandma's, too? Is grandma's panties? Whose panties were there? We know granny's not that big. Cora drew her in the first act.
And then there was also costume jewelry. And, of course, they had coerced him into admitting that he had stolen jewelry. So they took all this costume jewelry away, which the grandma said she used for sewing. I mean, Johnny didn't kill anybody, but he did dress up in ladies' underwear and wear fake jewelry and look in the mirror. Maybe. I don't know. Just another theory.
Maybe.
The views and opinions of the Stack Pack are not... do not support these allegations.
Yeah.
If you're the richest person in town, I wouldn't buy fake stuff. I'd go for the real deal.
Well, that was the whole thing with the costume. When they said they found jewelry, in all seriousness, I was like, well, that's maybe in the underwear. Maybe it gives you a little pause. And then it says costume jewelry. This is like the richest woman in Aurora.
Yeah.
Why does she have fake jewelry?
Right.
Like, I mean, maybe that's a thing. I don't know. In the 80s, they kept fake jewelry, but that was like...
And then number three on that bullshit list of things they found was a nearly empty gas can, which nobody has at their house. Oh, right. What?
The best was the cop's reenactment of how they discovered it. He's just like walking, strutting through the backyard, whistling like, oh! Empty gas. This is it. Smoking gun right here. Smoking gun this right here. My day's done.
Gasoline fire? Yep. Good day at work. All right, going home.
Gonna be home before dinner.
First of all, let's be honest. Somebody with an IQ of 71 and just in hearing him interviewed doesn't have the capacity to plan this in all seriousness. The way that it was for the strong arm robbery to bind and gag her and then to set the fire as a forensic countermeasure to destroy the evidence. He has his mother's panties in his dresser.
So I think that maybe it's a good time to have Bob at least explain the situation of what it's like for someone, you know, to be interviewed with this level of mental capacity. Like right, how to, because like, I know you, yeah, I know experience. You went through this with the West Memphis 3 case. Like what is common issues with doing that?
Well, I would love to see, and I don't because I'll go down a rabbit hole, but I would love to see the actual transcripts. They played little the reenactments of bits and pieces of them. But the things we're looking for in any kind of interview and confession like that is you're looking for, you're checking boxes. So any piece of information that comes out, where does it originate from? So is it something that he said, well, I put tape on her mouth and did this, or did they say, did you put the tape on her mouth? Didn't you put the tape on her mouth? And then especially with somebody with a lower IQ like that, you're really looking for they're highly suggestible people. So were the officers asking open-ended questions, or were they leading them and suggesting things to him? Right. Because oftentimes people in that situation, younger people in general, lower IQ especially, and anyone with that long of an interrogation, at some point wants to please authority, and they'll pretty much agree with anything they suggest. Jesse Ms. Kelly said yes to, I don't remember the number, it was like 125 questions during his interrogation. Damn. And said no to like 11. And of those 11, 8 of them no was an affirmative response. Mm-hmm. Like, you didn't do this, did you? No. Things like that.
They don't get into it this much, but the transcript of this interrogation, like the governor later will tell you about what the governor decided, but the governor... their office said that like over 50 pages were suggestible questioning.
Yeah,
I guess
out of a hundred page transcript, 50 pages had suggestive questioning. So for example, I was able to find a little bit of the transcript, and it only goes over a brief section or a question. And this is from the interrogator. It says, when Wilson was asked what Martz was wearing, he said, I'll say it was white, probably white or bluish. And the interrogator replied, okay, how about bluish? I'll go for that. Wilson's response was yes or yeah. Interrogator is like, how about bluish? Green, maybe? Wilson replied, yeah. So like exactly. They fed him the answer. They're like, was it green? I think so. Well, what if blue-green? Let's go ahead and say it's blue-green. Would you say it's blue-green? Yeah. So like they just sat there and kind of whittled them down.
Yeah, from the small segment that they did play, you could definitely tell that they were feeding him the information.
Yeah, and that rings exactly just like the Jesse Ms. Kelly interrogation. It was the same thing. Like in a proper interrogation, it's okay, so you were there, you did this. Describe the scene to me. What was she wearing?
Right.
And sit there and don't say a word until she answers it.
Oh, that kid wasn't even fucking friends with the other kids. It's so frustrating.
Fuck you, Gary.
Well, yeah, fuck Gary. Yeah, and then Gary. Fuck those West Memphis cops, too. Poor Jesse right, wasn't even friends too. With those two boys.
Yeah. It's
ridiculous.
Gary, you know what? You know who the lead inspector was in the West Memphis 3 case? Fucking Gary. Gary Gitchell.
Oh, there was another fucking...
There's just no good Garys out there.
Gary. Do you guys have any listeners named Gary?
Half of them are named Gary, Bob. Thanks a lot.
Gary, turn
the fucking podcast off. This isn't for you.
Yeah, all of you Garys, they have enough listeners. Fuck off. and stop listening.
They so after this, they have to go through another sort of questioning where they decide if he's fit to stand trial.
Dude, yeah.
And that's another interesting thing. One thing I got off, they say it's all transcripts. And one thing that kind of like he talks about how he was the manager of the football team and they gave him a jacket and everything. And I'm just like, I'm thinking like, it just kind of paints a picture of how like, and then we learn later, and when I look more into this case too, like how the whole town was just like, what? Like he burned an old nice lady alive? This dude? It just kind of paints a picture that like everybody kind of supported and was like decent.
It was the opposite of the West Memphis Three, where in that town they're all like, yeah, those Satanists, they all did it. They all turned on him. Where it sounded like in Aurora that the town didn't turn on Johnny, that they had his back.
Yeah, it's like
except for fucking Gary.
Those boys listen to Metallica. String them up.
Yeah, yeah. If he was like a goth or something, if he just because, you know, he was probably like a normal kid. If that's what set the West Memphis Three apart, just because they were a little different.
Yeah, if he hadn't been a good old boy, he never would have had the luck of the town.
That's actually funny because they say that he was a homeboy. It's not the same kind of homeboy that we're used to.
Yeah, yeah. He was a homeboy. Yeah, it's always weird hearing, like, even though you know that's not what she means, it's like an old lady saying homeboy. It's still kind of funny. Right. And it makes you think, like, because in the interrogation, one of the cops is like yelling at him and saying like, oh, did you done Gary wrong? Like, why would he lie about you or something like that?
Can we talk for a second about how we waited 45 minutes for David to get his video up and running, and then it was on for 1 minute and then shut it off to have his notes?
Yeah, that's pretty funny, David.
2 out of 3 psychiatrists decided that he was not fit to stand trial. But the third psychiatrist was the one appointed by the state, right? Or by the cops. Yeah. So they went with that one.
Yeah, of course.
Dr. Gary.
He's fit.
Is his name Gary too?
Yeah, of course it is.
I bet you. Yeah, and then his lawyers at this point just tell him to plead guilty so he avoids the death penalty, because apparently that judge has been pretty harsh on people who don't. So it's just super.
You think that's the same judge that when he said, "Do you understand what you're doing?" and he said,
"No,
no."
Yeah,
and he said, "Okay, cool, that's fine."
Okay, yeah, that's the same.
It's
one.
Cool. I go ahead and accept that plea of guilty.
Yeah, yeah. That's what Chris was talking about. This reenactment of this judge like just beating around the bush because the kid doesn't understand why he's pleading guilty to something he didn't do, and then he kept going and kept going, and then of course he accepted the guilty plea. Yeah. And of course, that means no. If you're guilty, then no trial, and then yeah, and then that's it. You're just in jail forever, right?
Yeah, it's so sad hearing about though. Like, Keith didn't understand what was going on.
Yeah, multiple times he says, "I don't know, I don't know," and like he just okay, you don't know, you're guilty because you said you're guilty.
What's interesting about this case is that usually we don't know if anything these reenactment actors are saying is like anything. Cause it's always, you know, you hear it and then Robert Stack starts talking over it because presumably the acting is shitty. But this one, they say everything is court transcript or from the interrogation.
Right.
So it's kind of interesting to be like, whoa, this was actually said. Like, yeah, and they didn't stop this shit.
For sure. It was said. Cause yeah, they don't do these reenactments like that normally. They usually just go by whatever the writing was. But he states that he didn't know what was going on. He thought that if he had said that if he didn't plead guilty, he thought he was going to die. That's what they said. That's basically his thought process. He didn't know at all what was going on.
Which is even more sick, man. It's just horrible.
Especially for his defense, not to explain like, well, if you get the death penalty, it's not instant. That would give you the opportunity to go through appeals court and all this other different avenues. Right. Instead, they're just like, just go ahead and plead.
Yeah, just terrible plead. Fucking lawyers.
Yeah.
In the interest of moving things along, you know who's the anti Gary? Fucking Chris. Fucking Chris knows snitches get stitches. Go. Chris is a gangster. Not you, Chris. The other Chris.
This terrible murdering piece of shit kind of saves the fucking day.
Right? And I was so confused. The thing that I caught too was not only does he save the day, but he says he did it with an unnamed accomplice because he's not about to snitch out
the other guy,
his accomplice. So he's the anti Gary.
Yeah.
But by the way,
he really is.
But he burned a bitch.
I have to say this. I was so confused.
He's a horrible human being. He's awful. I hope he's dead by now. I don't.
I was so confused for a second because I totally forgot that guy's name was Chris. So I'm like, I'm. I thought you were talking about me. I'm like, wait, what did I do?
So yeah, 2 years later, our hero Chris Brownfield, who is a Kansas man, being held in jail because he what was it, accessory to murder. He was in jail in Kansas for life. He found out about Johnny and pretty much just thought it was bullshit. And he hears about this. He hears that this kid who's mentally challenged was like coerced into confessing. He sees the Unsolved Mysteries episode. No, sorry, he doesn't see the Unsolved Mysteries episode.
Yeah, because
I wonder how he found out about this.
I think he just watched the show.
No, the show happened because of Chris.
Well, no, like I think he just saw Unsolved Mysteries.
But how did he know about the fact that?
No, he said that he had heard that a mentally challenged young man.
Probably through the news or something, because it made a lot of headlines. Because he even made the comments like, that boy was raised by his mama and grandmother, and
just
I
like
remember,
him.
Like it
he
a
just said
me.
When they interview him, he just said that he had found out. He doesn't say how. He just said that I found out that they got, you know, that boy, and they coerced him into confessing.
But what gets me, he felt bad for the dude because he got put away, and he was raised by his grandmother. But he didn't feel bad at the thought that he potentially killed someone else's grandmother.
Maybe his. They never really said. He killed someone's grandma.
That's a good
point. They said he had several or other cases, plural, with similar MO where he...
Yeah.
With elderly people. But yeah, the premise was that he... that he had heard about this case and that this kid got convicted of it. And he did it. So he called and said he's going to confess because it sounded like he was going to be in prison for the rest of his life anyway.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
It's just like, you know, what's the point in this kid being in prison? I'm going to be here forever.
He just felt sorry for him.
He was trying to better himself. He's like, I might have killed a couple grandmas in my day, but, you know, I'm not going to let anybody else go down for that.
I might have killed some blue hairs in my day, but...
I want him to go home to his grandma, who I could have killed if I was still out, but, you know...
Right, right. Luckily for him, I didn't kill his grandmother.
Look, he's probably thinking to himself, like, it's okay, his grandmother probably didn't make enough money for me to kill her, so...
Yeah, that's what I stopped myself from being like, I think she was too poor. That's not making the final cut.
It was a good demonstration of how fucked up the criminal justice system is, especially in Texas, where this guy comes forward, and that shit happens. People will do that kind of stuff, confess to stuff they didn't commit, get somebody else off the hook. Yeah. But he described the stun gun.
Yeah.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
That was huge, and that was never public knowledge. Like, that's case closed, and then they still didn't overturn his conviction.
Yeah.
They denied his request for his conviction to be overturned.
What did he say?
Yeah,
is it an elaborate escape plan?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. They didn't even say, were they even in the same fucking prison?
Right? Yeah, this guy, this kid, right? He's, you know, mentally challenged, and he comes up with this ruse to get this other guy somehow to confess to the murder, because as an elaborate plan to, like,
jeez.
In exchange for what? What's he going to give this guy to do it? His mother's panties?
Exactly.
Like, what does he
or
have?
Some costume jewelry.
Or some costume jewelry, or his bicycle, that if it didn't get burned up in the fire.
So Brownfield says that him and his unnamed homie, he won't rat him out, were tipped off that Martz was very rich, and they broke into the house,
you know,
taped her up.
Because snitches get stitches, that's why. And he ain't no snitch.
He ain't no stitch. Right. This guy's like, Granny Killer's probably still hanging out on a beach in the Caribbean with the costume jewelry and...
Grandma panties.
So they broke into her house. They taped her up, bound and gagged her, and they ransacked the place and burned it so there'd be no evidence. He even says that he was outside when his buddy lit the house on fire, and he was like, "Well, what about the old lady?"
Yeah, right. That was such bullshit. That part of his story, that he was trying to minimize, like
his involvement.
They showed the woman. I don't know if she was, but the actress they used for the reenactment was kind of a bigger lady. And they had her taped up and bound to the bed. And he, like, goes outside knowing the guy's going to set the house on fire. And he's like, dude, what'd you do with the fat old lady? Like, of course, what the fuck did you think he was going to do? Like, why would you go outside and not help with the lady? Give me a break.
I also think it,
and then he says that they went back to try to save her. Yeah, I'm not buying it. And the reenactment is just them running around like a bunch of doofuses around a burning house. Like,
yeah, you know how I burned up all those other old ladies? Well, I decided not to burn up this old lady, and I tried to save her, but it didn't work out. But those other old ladies I burned up, but not this one. This one I tried to help.
For this to work, you got to remove the old lady from the building before you set it on fire.
Oh, I forgot.
God. I feel like we forgot something.
Oh, the old lady.
We forgot to get the old lady out. Oh, it's all right. It's all right, Gary. We'll get it on the next one. We'll get it right on the next
one. Oh, shit. Was the accomplice Gary? All right, this is just fan theories now.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I do want to make a quick disclaimer that in my making light of this situation, I'm making fun of Chris's dumbass, not the poor old woman who was the victim of this crime. But fuck you, Chris. I mean, thanks, Chris, but
you know how I burned up all those other old ladies? I tried to save this one, though. Didn't work out.
So this gets out, the whole thing about Chris Brownfield coming forward. And the town starts rallying behind Johnny again, and people really start believing that he's innocent. There's even the billboard that says, like, "Welcome to Aurora, home of Johnny Lee
what
Miller."
Did you say?
Johnny Lee.
One billboard outside of Aurora, Missouri.
Yeah, one billboard outside of Aurora, Missouri, is what the town put up, and they were like, "The boy who never got a trial."
Home of Ray Finkel.
The Ray Finkel, the kicker.
Yeah,
I just think it's messed up too that they said it got what do they say? It was bombed, like a fire bombed well.
Yeah, by somebody
they kept firebombing it or something. I was just like, wow.
Shortly
that's
after it was erected, it got
the
fired.
Billboard,
yeah,
catching fire.
Yeah,
they firebombed the billboard.
I bet it was fucking Gary.
Who did it?
I was gonna say it was Gary. Definitely Gary.
And then another hero who's not. He's pretty close to Brownfield is D. Wampler, who's a lawyer they hired to reopen the case, right?
It's a great last name, Wampler.
It's a good lawyer name.
He's the guy who's like yelling at the reporters, like, they arrested a third grader for murder. Yeah. And we hear him talk and he just breaks it down and just nails the coffin. Hits the nail on the head, or what's the fucking expression? Where you're just like, God, these fucking cops are terrible.
We got to talk about like how they got him to come to interview without his parents, without a guardian, anything like that, and that they pulled him out of a movie at a movie theater and said, "Hey, we got your wallet
dude,
that you
he lost."
Lost
his wallet. He lost his wallet.
His billfolds
knew that he lost his wallet, and they're like, "Hey, did you lose a wallet, Johnny? Come with us. We found it."
Yeah, and then bam, you committed a murder. You're going to jail.
But what about WrestleMania?
poor old Johnny just wanted his wallet.
Yeah, it's super shitty. So, and that's the night where they interrogate him and, you know, till for like 4 hours and shit. And then he maintains his innocence until they keep yelling at him and yelling at him. And then one of the other investigators brings up how somebody with a normal mental capacity would be like, yeah, I know my rights. Give me a fucking lawyer. Like, you can't just sit here and just accuse me of shit for hours and hours and hours. But that was just nothing that ever came to mind. That was nothing that he ever thought of. He didn't know he had that option.
Yeah.
His interpretation of the Miranda rights was something that is good and bad.
Oh, yeah, that was sad, too. Miranda rights were just, his answer was just the difference, knowing the difference between right and wrong.
Oh, man, it makes you feel for him even worse.
Yeah, they say that they interrogated him, handcuffed. He confessed, they handcuffed him, sent him to Mount Vernon. And that's it, man. He's just in jail forever now. That's it. All right, good night, guys.
All right, end of episode. Yeah. Bob's covering his case next season.
He's still in jail.
No, he's not in jail.
But before we get into the governor, there was also this former sheriff deputy who was looking into the case a couple years after, and he found so many ridiculous discrepancies. It was later confirmed that the jewelry was the grandma's, the undies were his mom's, if that's good or bad, I don't know. And that there was actually a gas can found at the crime scene that just was never entered into evidence.
Oh, no way. I didn't catch that.
Yeah, that was, like, horrible.
There was no evidence besides fucking Gary, and then the confession that
the mystery bike.
The mystery bike. If it was there,
yeah, they never say anything about the mystery bike. That's just us, right? Like, where's this bike? He probably biked home from school, right? Because the day starts with him. Maybe was that a weekday?
I don't know.
No, because they explain the day with him dropping the bike off, right?
Yeah, on his way to school. Right?
But so presumably he goes back home, so the bike. I don't think the bike would be there.
But they never mentioned it, so we just kind of speculated.
To tape records.
Yeah, I don't know. Google it. And then also the stun gun that was actually found at the scene, like Bob said, that fucking Chris Brownfield actually drew, and it was green, bright green. He drew a picture of it, and they, when they asked poor Johnny Lee what the about a stun gun, he didn't know what a stun gun was. I think they showed him a picture, and he thought it was an electric razor. And Brownfield said he lost his fucking stun gun during the robbery. And that part was not publicized, wasn't in any papers, and still nobody did anything about this.
Well, yeah, and not only did they not do anything about it, but they took it before a judge. They filed a writ for an exoneration for actual innocence to set the conviction aside, and it was denied. Like, what more evidence do you need? They denied it. So he was going to be in prison for the rest of his life had it not been for the governor.
Yeah, they said at the end of the initial segment in Unsolved Mysteries, they say that he wouldn't have been eligible for parole until he was 70. And they had to put him in protective custody because they were scared that he couldn't defend himself from like normal, harsh, tough prison life. It's weird they didn't even consider him putting him in like a safer place. I want to say like a mental hospital, but that I don't know. Because don't they do that like sometimes if someone's like if they're
but he wouldn't qualify for that. I mean, he was just at a mild cognitive impairment level,
so that wouldn't have been an option.
They would throw him into general population.
He wasn't crazy; he just processed information slower than everyone else,
or on a more simpler level.
Okay.
Yeah.
The original segment ends with Robert Stack saying, "In September 1990, there was a new appeal that was also denied." And there was a long while before anything else happened with this. And somebody brought it up to this to a governor, Governor Mel Carnahan, and his office looked into it. And after a year-long review is what it said, they concluded that he had been manipulated by cops into confessing a crime he didn't commit. He still was in jail for 9 years, but he did get out of jail in 1995. Did anybody else look any further into this? I found an article from like April of 2017 where he still lives with his mom and he has a lawn business and stuff.
Yeah.
Still lives in Aurora.
I did a little reading up, and it talks about like after he got out, he subsequently sued the Lawrence County as well as the sheriff at the time, David Tanum, as well as the investigators of the case, citing that they violated his constitutional rights.
He got some money, right?
Yeah,
The county tried to counter for limited immunity, stating that the police officials were just acting within their scope of public duties, at which point the judge of the appeals 8th Circuit reviewed the case and was just like, no, I've reviewed the evidence. You maliciously set this person up with a lower cognitive skill set to plead to this, so I'm not going to ignore the case, and basically ruled in his favor. Unfortunately, due to the insurance that the county had, the maximum he could have gotten was like $615,000.
Well, that's what he got, right?
Yeah, he got $615,591.
Good for that senator, man. What a badass.
Another interesting thing is that after he got out, whatever county Aurora, Missouri was in, like the sheriffs like stood by convicting him, and they said that they were not happy with him being released and stuff. They said it was political, that had nothing to do with him being innocent, and they stand by arresting him.
Yeah, total BS.
What a bunch of cowards. It's like, there's been so much time that I guess it was only 9 years at that time, but it's like, what a bunch of assholes. Like, come on. And this poor kid got garried. What other wrongfully convicted people are out there just getting garried, man? Fuck.
It happens all the time.
And they even mention, they try to I remember one of the people that they interviewed, one of the talking heads, they talked about how they're like, oh, this never happens. This is probably like one out of 1,000 that we got wrong.
Yeah.
If those are your practices, then that's not true.
Yeah, it's like now with the internet and, you know, armchair detectives and...
And Bob Ruff.
Well, yeah. Bob, you wouldn't be considered an armchair detective because you go out there.
No, yeah.
You don't fuck around. You get off that armchair.
Yeah, I don't know what the definition exactly is of armchair, but yeah, we go get into some shit sometimes. Yeah.
I mean, I think armchair detective is just people who just dive deep via their internet and computer, yeah, is what I understand.
Deep on Reddit.
Which can be an awful...
But, you know, really, that's kind of the power in what we do with the Truth and Justice podcast is not... I mean, yeah, I'm out there doing stuff, and I've even drug Chris and Elias into some of our shenanigans a couple of times.
Oh, I've heard some stories. But it's for that stuff to come out.
It's the... But what makes everything so powerful is the audience that are, I guess, armchair detectives that contribute whatever they have to contribute. And it's just... That's a whole lot of eyes looking at a case, and we've had a lot of success figuring things out.
It's like cloud computing, especially now today. Like, everyone can research and scan through documents and evidence with a lot more detail than one single detective can do. It's amazing. Like, we live in an age where information is readily available, and it's cool that your podcast can do shit like that.
I'm on like 6 or 7 of the Melgar episodes, and I don't know. I don't have an opinion yet. I was telling Eli I knew for sure, and then like I listened to like 40 more minutes, and I was like, I don't know.
Yeah, the funny thing is, this is the first time when we produced a season when we kind of intentionally hid the ball a little bit and wanted to, because we don't want to have an echo chamber as far as like everybody's like, hey, yeah, they're innocent, and nobody's looking at the other viewpoint, mm-hmm, because that's how we find holes in our theories and stuff. So we intentionally tried. We gave all, you know, we didn't manipulate anything, but we put out as much evidence of her guilt as possible up front.
Oh.
Yeah, and then started dismantling, and so yeah, it's got, so I've heard that reaction by a lot of people, that so that was what we were shooting for. I don't know if it's the right way to go or if it's going to blow up in our fucking faces, but that was the plan, and it seems to be working.
Well, what's funny is like you guys were talking about you were talking to that prosecutor before we started recording, but like what I got out of it was like your responses were just like, God, you were agreeing and like having the conversation, but your tone of voice was just like, I was like, oh, Bob doesn't believe any of, like, Bob doesn't think, I don't know.
she didn't know that I had already been studying the case for months before I talked to her. She thought I was just getting into it. And so, but yeah, I didn't want to argue with her. I wanted her to be able to lay her case out, but yeah, I was trying to mask that, but yeah, I'm sure you could catch that. Some of the things she said, I was like, that's not at all.
it's good. It's really, it's very intriguing. It's been very interesting. This one, I feel like I know. I feel like I know. Do you guys feel like you know, but Unsolved Mysteries didn't say?
I don't know, man. Like, if this guy did it, then he's a freaking psychopath.
Yeah, no kidding.
So this next case is, it's the last case of the night. This has been pretty fun, guys. This is an unexplained death, and we're talking about a guy named Kenneth Angie. He was a rough 27, at least by the guy in the reenactment.
There we go.
This guy looked like he lived pretty hard for a 27-year-old.
He looked like someone Cora would draw.
Bringing it back.
Yeah, when I saw this, I totally thought.
Do you think that he looks like somebody Coral would draw because he's dead,
or because he's old, or he looks old?
Well, yes.
We're talking about Demore. Was it Demore, North Dakota?
Edmore.
Okay. Edmore, North Dakota. Thanks, guys. 27-year-old Kenneth Angie. Blah, 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 blah. So he's found dead by his uncle, Dr. Richard Nygaard from Parks and Recreation.
Chris Traeger's therapist.
He's found dead in his garage by his uncle, and it's pretty much immediately ruled a suicide because the way he died was massive carbon monoxide poisoning. So, but immediately the stuff around his body kind of confused the suicide theory. There was a loaded rifle on the floor about 6 feet away from his body. There was like a small pool of blood, which they don't really get into more than that.
Yeah, they don't get into at all.
And then the gas tank in his car was pretty much full, and the car was off. So they think that would be weird if he committed suicide and turned the car off and was laying on the floor outside of the car.
Dead.
And then there was a loaded gun as well.
So this kind of maybe a weird question for everybody here, but like going to our expert criminal analysis person here on the call, Bob Ruff, people when they die of what is it called when someone chokes you to death? Yeah, that one. Yeah.
Asphyxiation?
Yeah, asphyxiation. Yeah. They bleed out of their mouth. Is that, do you think that would be true with carbon monoxide? Is that how the pool of blood happened?
It could, but I mean, typically it's a pretty slow and quiet, painless death. I mean, people just go to sleep and stay asleep.
Yeah, I don't know what happens in the lungs when somebody can't breathe, basically, or if that would even be the same thing. Different streams being choked.
CO poisoning, it transfers through your lungs into your bloodstream, and it displaces oxygen in your blood, and you get poisoned through your blood. But honestly, I don't know. I've been to a few CO deaths, and there was never any edema or blood spewing out of mouths or anything like that. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. I've just never seen it.
I mean, they did say like a small pool, but yeah. But then it's like typical unsolved mysteries. Like they like drop a little thing, and then they never bring that back up again.
Yeah, and I looked it up. There's
Johnny's
nothing.
Fucking bike.
Well, it's funny you say that about the whole suffocation and CO2 poisoning. A lot of states are going to these new gas chambers that replace the oxygen in the room with nitrogen, so you just get lightheaded and die.
For the death penalty? Wow.
For the death penalty, because it's a lot more humane, because you don't really know what's going on. You just get lightheaded and disoriented. You lose awareness of the situation to where it's a more pleasurable way to go than getting poisoned.
I don't know if that sounds pleasurable at all. That sounds not pleasurable.
Dying.
That
sounds terrifying.
Dying definitely doesn't sound pleasurable. Never.
So there's a company that's trying to make it legal as suicide machines as well.
They don't know what's going on. It looks suspicious. It's weird. And 12 hours later, they think they found a suspect. Now we're going to be talking about Curtis Heck. And Curtis was also a mechanic. I didn't mention that our boy Kenneth Engie was a mechanic, and so was this guy Curtis Heck. So it's 2 a.m. They're at a bar on the main street of Edmore. The bar is called Kunkel's Bar.
Amazing
and
name.
They're the last two people there. They're hanging out. Kenneth wants to take the bartender home. She's a girl.
You're coming home with me tonight, is what he tells her.
Yeah, and she's like, no, I'm getting a ride with Curtis. And then Kenneth and Curtis get in a little fight because they both want to take home the girl, the barmaid. Did you notice that Robert Stein called her a barmaid?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You bar wench.
Not the proper nomenclature, dude.
The bar wench.
Yeah, it's like, Jesus, guys. So the bartender, so they get in a fight. They're, like, punching each other. And Curtis even explains it, like, neither of us was Muhammad Ali. He's like, we got each other on the floor. There were some punches. He said, I got on top of him and said, like, I'm going to let you up, but you better walk out that door. So he gets up, and they walk right, and Kenneth walks out the door. And then, of course, a couple of minutes later, he hears crash, and Kenneth broadsided the guy's truck with his car and left and took off. He called her a tramp too. It's like, you are a tramp, aren't you?
He did.
In the reenactment.
Yeah. Oh man. Like, I don't know. I will never. One of the biggest unsolved mysteries is actually about the show Unsolved Mysteries. Were there fucking scripts for these reenactments? Cause goddamn, sometimes the wording is just so like, it just seems like they were improvising, like, okay, you guys are in this scene, go. And they would just go with it.
If there were scripts, can you imagine that writing room? Like, okay, guys, I got the line. He's going to say, you are a tramp, aren't you? And then there's like five other guys in the room that are like, God, that's gold. That's gold. Yeah, that's it.
That's great. That's what he would say. And there's like one lady intern that's just crying in the back.
It's the 80s, so she was underpaid and just taking notes.
So Heck gets mad, obviously, and Heck says that, like, that he that he's like, I could have left it, but we're both body men. If I have to fix my car, he's got to fix his car.
Yeah.
This is when Robert Sack says, "Heckin the barmaid arrived an hour later at Kenneth's home," and Kenneth and Curtis gets out of the car and starts just kicking.
kicking shit
in his truck, just kicking that truck, and it doesn't. It's like, dude, he bashed into your car, and you're just like, just putting little boot to his Bronco or whatever it was. Those things are American steel, baby.
Yeah, as I say, quality steel right there. Barely even did any damage.
I don't care if you. I don't care how good those steel toe boots are, man. I don't know. It just seemed kind of funny. Like he's like, "Huh? You gonna crash into me? I'm gonna put a footprint on your door.
Put a boot in your ass."
So. Yeah, this is when the weirdness happens. And then Curtis hears noises coming from the garage. So he goes around, opens the door, and sees Kenneth on the floor all, like, what he assumes is, like, wasted and drunk. And he's like, "Man, you totaled my car, shucks!" And he, like, slams the door and leaves.
Shucks.
You can go straight to heck.
Oh, jeez.
I have to just say this really quick, but to talk about this. This is a mechanic, a guy that knows cars. Being a car guy here, I've like red flags going off here, because he walks in there into the garage, he's yelling at him for wrecking his car or whatever, right? Sees he's on the ground moaning, whatever. Obviously, we're looking at a reenactment. We don't know what really 100% happened, and then doesn't care enough to see if he's okay,
right?
But cares enough to go turn his truck off because he doesn't want him to die from carbon monoxide.
That's one of the sheriff's theories. So let's start getting into the theories. So, you know, Curtis leaves and then eventually he's dead and we don't know. So, I don't know. Like, let's figure that Curtis thinks he's sick from drinking. Let him, and he's like, "I figured he was sick from drinking. Let him spend the night on the garage floor." So he says he just left. And I kind of believe him. It's only when Larry, chief of police, it just comes up with this weird theory. So Curtis comes home and Kenneth comes home. He knows Curtis is coming for him because he just crashed into his car. So he waits in his garage and he starts the truck because he gets cold. He falls asleep and he wakes up and he hears Curtis like fucking with his truck, right? So he gets his gun and can't make it to the door and he collapses and dies. But Curtis sees him, comes in, and he's like, "Let me turn off the truck." Or what the uncle thinks is that he turned off the truck, but they also got into another fight. And that's why he was down. Because he's like, he was a mechanic. He wouldn't leave the car on in a small garage. It makes no sense. That's what the uncle thought. But there was no evidence of anybody, any physical assault on the body. Just the carbon monoxide poisoning. So, yeah, the uncle story is just dumb, is what I said. He thinks that they fought in the garage and then he turned off the car before beating him so he wouldn't die. What I think is, maybe he fell asleep and he accidentally left the car on and then he hears somebody get up. So he's like, he turns off the car. "Let me get my gun." But he's so fucking out of it at that time, he just falls and doesn't make it to the door. Or he was just like, "I can't get a girl and... I just bashed into someone's truck and he was trying to kill himself." I kind of think maybe this. Maybe he was trying to commit suicide. And then he hears Curtis like messing with his truck and he's like, "Fuck this." He turns off his car and he gets his gun, but he doesn't make it to the door.
I kind of thought with the gun and all the circumstances around it that he had every intention of killing himself and the gun might have been to use on himself. Mm. And he couldn't get the nerve to do it. Decided to do the carbon monoxide route and sat there and died. But then as far as the truck being turned off, maybe other guy, what's the other guy's name?
Yeah, it's confusing because it's Gary. Curtis. Kenneth and Curtis.
Yeah, so maybe he comes in, finds him there dead, and then shuts the car, maybe tries to help for a minute, shuts the car off and is like, "Oh shit, he's dead. I just got in a fight with him. I'm getting the fuck out of here."
Oh,
yeah.
And left.
That makes way more sense.
That does make way more sense.
That's why I do what I do, guys.
Yeah.
Like the whole ambush theory kind of also makes sense too, that he was waiting in the garage and just collapsed from either drunkenness or carbon monoxide. Because you also got to take into account that carbon monoxide is a lot heavier than air. So if he fell down onto the ground, even though the door was open, that carbon monoxide is still concentrated at a lower level.
Yeah, and he says that he didn't smell any fumes when he opened the door.
which who's to say you wouldn't see, if you were on the ground, you would smell it.
Yeah, I think he was just, like, gonna kill himself, and he just heard somebody fucking with his truck, and he's like, oh, fuck this, I'm gonna go stop. But then he just fell. I really don't think, I don't know. I don't think Curtis...
I think he had the gun in the truck with him waiting, like, oh, this guy, like, he knows I backed into him. I was the only one in this bar. He's going to come back to my place, and we're going to start some shit.
But why not wait
and
for him outside?
Start some shit.
Why not wait for him in his own car, in his own truck?
Because if it's on his property,
then you can claim stand your ground. We would have to dive deeper into the laws back then.
The one question I have, though, is there's that picture at the beginning of this of the guy in the red shirt laying down. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing that is the actual crime scene photo.
Yeah, probably.
If that's the crime scene photo, if you look at where the gun is, like... What you're saying is that, like, he got out of the truck and just fell. Like, the gun is so far away from where...
6 feet.
6 feet, yeah.
So, like, I don't... I mean, possibly.
But
I'm not saying you're wrong.
He's staggering. Like, he's trying to, like, you know, a drunken stagger.
You don't think it could have slid? I don't know.
I like Bob's theory. I think that makes the most sense, actually, to be honest with you.
That they did get in a fight?
I think that it just... To me, it just screams that... Someone probably tried to help. That's why the car's off. That's the first thing you're going to do, shake him, shut the car off, open it up, and then realize that he was dead. And since the other guy, now the other guy admits enough to at least place himself at the scene, probably knows there's evidence that he was at the scene. I think that he probably maybe shut it off, tried to help, and was like, shit, they're going to think I killed him, and concocted this ridiculous bullshit story and got out of there.
They know the guy died from... carbon monoxide poisoning, and they realized that the truck was off, but no one ever bothered to, you know, dust the car for fingerprints.
I guess because they thought that he...
The key for fingerprints.
When they roll it a suicide, they're not going to go through all that the rigmarole. They're just going to say, oh, he did it himself.
Yeah, we learned that in that other case last week.
Yeah, they're just going to say, oh, well, he offed himself, whatever.
He's dead. Let's move on.
Let's go home. Let's go grab some lunch.
Nope, it's 4 p.m. Got to go.
Good detecting. All right, see you later.
Great detecting today, guys.
Yeah, this one, I don't know. When I first watched it, I was pretty sure. I was like, yeah, you know what? He just killed himself. But I don't know. His uncle said... His uncle...
It's just hard, man. When you lose somebody like that, you don't want to believe that they took themselves out that way. So the family, of course, is going to say, oh, he'd never do that. So
yeah, that was a rough 27. He looked like he'd lived some lives. Do you think that was really the crime scene photo? It kind of looked like the reenactment, but...
No, but I mean, I want to think that they base it off of the crime scene photos. I'd like to
think. I don't think they actually have show any crime scene photos on Unsolved Mysteries.
I don't think
we've ever
seen any.
Well, what's going on? What's going on next week, man? We got some, like...
Dude, some weird stuff's going on next week. I don't know. That lady that... honestly, I was just like, I don't know what's going on.
It's such a weird episode. Robert Stack only mentioned one case at the end of the show.
Yeah, I didn't look into the next week.
Let me tell you about
the next
case.
Ooh, Chris has got it this week.
It's about voodoo victims, Skeleton Canyon, and North Carolina Nightmare, and England Air and UD.
Update. UD is okay. Update.
Sorry, I'm not down with the lingo.
Good job. Good job, Chris.
Well, yeah, thanks so much for joining us. I don't think I got to tell anybody here. You guys should really check out Truth and Justice with Bob Ruff. It's pretty good stuff. He leaves the armchair and, like, dives deep, and it's pretty, pretty great.
Boots on the ground. Boots in people's asses, speaking of.
What kind of boots? Like, Texas boots, worker boots, detective boots?
They're Doc Martens.
Firefighter boots.
Equestrian
it's
boots?
It's been a treat to hear your voice talking along with us, talking about the godfather of true crime, Robert Stack. You know, even though he was just a host, right? Because now there's, like, this great new renaissance in this cool podcasting medium. It's super cool. There's lots of spectrums. Like, you're seriously investigating crimes and we're just making fun of terrible 80s reenactments. And there's room for all of it, and it's super cool, man. We really appreciate you hanging out with us.
I really enjoyed it. I appreciate you guys having me on, and ask me back anytime.
Woo. Oh yeah, we'll definitely take you up on that. And
maybe I'll come back on.
Maybe we'll have our shit together a little more.
No, this was great. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, dude, it's been a lot of fun. Also, Chris Brinkley, and Eli, who run the fan page for Truth and Justice, and thanks so much for being with us, Chris.
And I appreciate you guys letting me come check this out and see how this, you know, how this happens in the background. I've been listening now actually for a while since Eli told me about it.
Thank you.
I love the episode.
I always get like all insecure a little bit. I'm like, ooh, somebody listens to my podcast. I hope they like it.
I have to make eye contact with, like on a.
Exactly. I just have to say, and we got to give props to the like cheesy as hell 90s graphics.
Absolutely.
This is the first Unsolved Mystery episode I've watched since I was a kid, and I was just like
taken back.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, really? So you just kind of like follow along with the podcast and like maybe Google some names if it's an interesting case.
Yeah.
You haven't actually like sat down.
Yeah, I don't listen to it.
No,
and
I
just like
I
sunk into the nostalgia.
I haven't watched any of the episodes yet, but I had to watch this one obviously, and I was just like, dude, like I want to go back to season one now and like watch all of them because it was like I remember.
There's some good ones. Man. There's some good ones. There's also
watch an episode from like season one and then watch an episode from like season eight.
Yeah,
and it'd just be like, whoa, man! Like they got mad 90s with it.
And the production.
Or watch Dennis Farina.
Nah, fuck Farina. And fuck Gary.
Yeah,
by the way, one last
right,
time.
Fuck Gary. Is that the title of this episode? Fuck Gary.
It's gotta be. Fuck Gary with Bob Ruff.
That's my cue. See you guys.
You can add one more disclaimer before you leave, Bob.
Yeah,
and once again, the opinions of the Stack Pack Podcast are not necessarily those of Bob Ruff, Truth and Justice, or NBI Studios. And in fact, please don't associate us with anything that was said on this podcast today, even the thing said by Bob Ruff.
I think you cleared all. Yeah. You cleared all your bases there. That was good. Yeah. Well, we're the Stack Pack on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. Hang out with us. We'll be back next week. Like I said, check out Truth and Justice with Bob Ruff and have a great week. For every mystery, there is somebody somewhere who knows the truth, and perhaps that someone is listening, and perhaps that someone is you. Good night, guys.
Awesome. All right.